Viktor Frankl said, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson. Stay tuned for the next hour as Sue explores the human psyche, what makes us tick, and how to live better, more fulfilled, and more meaningful lives. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program on 101.9 High FM. My guest today is Rabbi Levi Avtson. And Rabbi Avtson is the rabbi at the Lingsfield Cedarwood Synagogue. He is my rabbi and my teacher, and he has been for many, many years. And I really welcome him being on my program today. Rabbi, I know you've had a very hectic week and weekend. So to see you actually smiling today is really good. Welcome.
You can't do this job if you can't smile after a weekend. but thank you, Sue. It's been a while, but we've been on the show quite a few times, and it's a privilege, and I look forward.
Well, I certainly look forward to having you on my program, and it's because of you that I actually am on High FM. Many years ago, you said to me that you thought I should come and be a presenter on High FM, and I got hold of Kathy, and the rest is history. And if anyone would like to listen to Rabbi Avtson on High FM, there are many podcasts of him on it, on the different High FM, on different topics. He is not doing it at the moment because he is far too busy with our own community and many other communities too. Rabbi, you know, I've called our program Connecting the Dots. And the dots are the many directions that we are pulled in as we try to connect with our lives. We are pulled in so many directions. I know that a group of rabbits is called a fluffle. What is a group of rabbis called?
A group of rabbis is just a bunch of distracted fellows trying to, you know, fetch about their members together.
I like that, and I thought perhaps you could give us something which would connect the dots. You brought out a very good newsletter, and it's about the rules. You said nobody grows up dreaming of rules. Why did you feel that you wanted to write that article?
Because it's my experience as a human being. At some stage, every one of us that is thinking and exploring and has an identity comes against the rules of life, whether it's rules of religion or rules of community or rules of society, and resents it. That's part of growing up. Growing up is finding your own voice, and part of finding your own voice is pushing boundaries. And often in adolescence or young adulthood, we push against rules. We see them as silly, right? The famous expression, he who's not a communist at age 20 has no heart. He who's still a communist at 30 has no brain. In other words, there's something about young adolescence and young thinking that says, you know, no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. And then as you start getting into life and you take on the responsibilities of adulthood, relationships, children, jobs, societal responsibilities, you suddenly start realizing if you're looking out, if you're a student of life, you realize that rules, most rules, not all rules, some rules are ridiculous, but most rules, especially rules that have carried society over millennia, are not that stupid. And me without rules, I'm not that safe.
And do you believe that children feel a lot safer in a home that has rules?
No question. And no question. You could see very quickly when you meet a child, if this is a child growing up in a home with rules or a child growing home without rules. And the child without rules, even though the parents think they're doing it out of love, the child is chaos, okay? It's like showing up to a game and there's no rules. So, right, even they're playing a basic game of soccer, of, you know, football, and suddenly there's no rules. There's nothing. It's just chaos because what are we playing? What's the game? Once you have the rules, or even art, right? You just give a child, a two-year-old, some paint and paper. Yes, it's charming, and you'll say that's fantastic. But if at age 10 they're still painting like a two-year-old, that's not impressive. You hope that they pick up some basic art, some basic skills, some basic ideas, and they start painting within the lines until they can figure out how to actually paint. So yes, rules are God's gift.
And, you know, talking about rules, I have to agree with you, but our oldest grandchild, Gabby, said to my husband, Leon, and I, Rabbi knows Leon well, she said, you know, I can't believe how undisciplined all my younger cousins are. So I said, what do you mean? She said, you and Zayda and my mom and dad never let us get away with the things you let your other grandchildren, your younger grandchildren, get away with. And it got me thinking, and I thought, wow, have we slackened? Is it just a lack of responsibility on our part? You know, what is actually being called on us in this generation of young grandchildren?
So it's interesting. I'm not a grandparent yet, so I can't. And I actually never grew up with grandparents. Thank God my kids have grandparents, and I'm very blessed for that. I think, yes, grandparents, I don't think it's the role to enforce rules. I do think parents it is. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, it's much harder in the short term to have rules than it is not to have rules. In the long term, it's much harder not to have rules because you will pay the price. But in the moment, your kids come and says, come on, do I really have to go to bed? Do I really have to go to the shower? I don't want to eat breakfast. I don't want to go to school. It's so much easier to say, darling, do what you want. Because I don't have to dig deep and enforce and put boundaries and assert my authority as a parent, as an adult. But the problem is that moment of weakness and lack of assertion, I'll pay the price and my child will pay the price for quite a while.
Absolutely. And, you know, Leon and I were in Israel lately, as you know, and we were looking after grandchildren, and Israeli grandchildren are quite a lot different to the South African grandchildren. Each one thinks definitely that they are the future president of the country, or prime minister, should I say. And we were enforcing some rules, which we had a lot of objection to, not only from our grandchildren, but from grandparents and parents on the other side too.
Yeah, rules are, I'll be honest, I think a lot of young parents, they actually have an aversion to rules. It's a philosophical thing. I think it's because we've grown up in the therapy generation, and I'm very pro-therapy within the right context. But as a way of life, what basically we've been told the whole time is to focus on how messed up our parents were and how they messed us up and our terrible teachers. And basically you grow up with this narrative that you keep on hearing over and over and over, that all your kids need is love and love and love and love and yes, and validate their feelings and big feelings and how you're feeling today and listening to them ad nauseum. And it's like, yes, there's a truth to that, but it's not the truth. It's just a truth. It's one side of the equation. But when you totally throw the baby out with the bathwater and you totally forget that rules are healthy, the human being without rules is an uncontained, unrestrained animal. Even your pet needs basic rules, right? Your dog, you tell your dog, okay, don't do that. Go there. Why? Because without rules, we're wild. We're anarchy. The Torah tells us that a human being is born as a wild animal, an animal of the wild. Without rules, I will not activate my better self. I will not access it.
That's so true. It really is. And you say, thank God for rules, because without them, we unravel. And I think that's very, very true. And you see it so often in today's world of teenagers leaving school and not knowing what they want to do, going on their own gap years or whatever they might be going on, and unraveling there because there is no structure that has brought them to this stage to actually go into a gap year or a year where there are even less rules.
And it's interesting, I would say even more than adolescence or a gap year, I'm finding more and more people in middle age that are unraveling, people in their 40s and 50s that basically held it together while they were building their family because they were able to occupy themselves chasing their kids and chasing their career. And at some stage, most of their kids are out of school and the career has relatively stabilized itself and that drive is no longer as there. And suddenly all their underlying stuff, purpose, and part of the underlying stuff is like that inability of self-regulation. You know, in the shul business, and I'm sure it's not just synagogues, in any religious institution, you get to see the most majestic part of people and you get to see the most fallible part. And one of the most fallible part is how you see adults falling apart, unraveling. And you're like, how? What? You're a competent person. You have 3 degrees. You know, you've built a marriage. But like, unless you've integrated the discipline of rules and the discipline of faith and the discipline of anchoring yourself within a healthy environment, even adults can unravel.
Absolutely. And we're going to get back to that shortly.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Finding Human program. I'm Sue Jackson on 101.9 High FM. My guest today is Rabbi Levi Upson, and we're about to hear a very short YouTube by Rabbi Upson called Meaninglessness.
Imagine you're walking down the street and someone punches you in the face and knocks out your tooth. You'd be furious. And yet you do the same thing. You go to the dentist, you pay them 2,000 rand to pull out your tooth. What's the difference? And you even say thank you after, because one was meaningful and one was meaningless. So if you're doing something like you got punched and your tooth is out, that's meaningless. It feels meaningless. But if the tooth was taken out on purpose and there was intention, then suddenly the pain becomes a million times more bearable, even though it's hard.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson on the Finding Human program. My guest today is Rabbi Levi Upson, and you are listening to High FM 101.9 High FM. Sorry, I'm working from home, and so is the rabbi, and I got a bit muddled up there with what Craig was trying to tell me. Rabbi, that was a short audio clip of you talking about the meaninglessness, how one thing, if you're punched in the face, you're furious. Let's just go back to that for a moment.
Let's explore that. Actually, I think I heard it from Rabbi Manus Friedman many years ago, and it stuck with me. He says, let's say someone walks over to you on the street and punches you in the face and knocks out your tooth. Okay. You're going to have them arrested if possible. You're going to be angry at them, and chances are you're never going to talk to them for a long time. And you'll tell your kids to stay away, and you might get a restraining order. However, if you have a problem with your tooth, you'll go to the dentist. You'll open your mouth wide. You'll sit there for 45 minutes as the guy's digging into your mouth in the most uncomfortable way. You'll be hating every minute, but at the end of it, you'll walk by. You'll give your medical aid number. You'll be charged, 1,500 rand for the appointment, and you'll say, thank you, doctor. So both guys took a tooth out. What's the difference? And the difference is one was felt meaningless, because just a guy just punched you in the face, and the other one, you understood. You had a problem with your tooth. There's a rot in the root, and therefore you have to take it out. So the same event could go on, and one time it's meaningful, and one time it's meaningless. So it's not fundamentally the event that's good or bad. For example, pain in life. Is pain a good thing or a bad thing? Depends what kind of pain. If it's the pain of taking out a bad tooth, if it's the pain of taking out a cancer, then it's a very worthy pain. If it's pain that seems meaningless, then it's much more harder to bear. So in life, we're often terrified of pain. Well, we're terrified of suffering. But the truth is that that's not what's really scary. What's scary is meaningless pain.
Absolutely. I have to agree. And I was reading something by Moshe Eliyahu, who is a part of an organization. He works for Ahel Yehudi. And he lost his brother and his brother-in-law in the war in Gaza. And he did 530 days on reserve duty in Gaza. And he was in the Home Front Battalion. And his brother used to say, every fracture has a purpose. And it helps us understand that every break, when we are shattered, that's the time to rise. That it's the future to that is whether we fracture it and have no purpose in it, or if we find a purpose in that new fracture.
Correct. And that's all, you know, I know that you're a logotherapist, and one of your big heroes is Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl's big idea, which is obviously a very religious idea, but he gave it a psychological framing, is the idea that the moment you have a framing, you have meaning, you can endure a lot, right? He quoted Nietzsche, and that's basically the heart of his book. He who has a why can endure anyhow. Mm. And the why is the meaning. When people, and I wrote an article a few weeks ago called A Crisis of Meaninglessness, because I really believe that right now we're living through a time of a huge crisis of meaninglessness, where people are not, they're going through the roots of life. They're going and getting their job. They're trying to build a family. They're trying to make relationships, But the underlying buzz is a deep lack of why. Why are you doing this? What's the point? Right, one person reached out to me yesterday and said, Rabbi, what's the point of all the suffering? And I said, to be honest, welcome to real life. Until you haven't asked that question, your journey in life hasn't even started. If you're still at the stage of life where you think the point of life is getting 8 distinctions, being magnificent and being popular, then you haven't even started the journey. The real journey of life only begins once you realize the hardship and you try to find meaning to it.
And that is the hardest part. And you have brought out many articles. And the one article that I was reading about that you had brought out, just hang on one moment, was Carefree Isn't Free and the Case for Real Freedom. Can you just tell me, why did you write that? You wrote it in April 2025, so it was almost this time last year.
Yeah, I wrote it for Pesach, and wow, you really did your homework. I'm flattered. Carefree.
I read your work.
Thank you. Carefree is basically this idea of, like, do what you want, which is, you know, as old as society itself. This idea of eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. And it always seems to make a comeback, even though it leads to such moral decay of a society and an individual. Because if you're just literally acting like a 20-year-old for the rest of your life, you're not actually evolving as a human being. One of my favorite memes, I love memes, and that's my weakness. So one of my favorite memes is a guy that says, I'm 40, but I feel like 20. And then I hung around a bunch of 20-year-olds, and I'm like, never mind, I'm actually 40. like at some stage in life, this carefree attitude, you realize, is not free. You know, we love joking, for example, jokes about marriage, right? Marriage has probably more jokes than any other institution, right? You wish a person a 50th wedding anniversary, and every single one of them says, if I had done murder, I would have been out 25 years ago, right? It's like that perpetual. Now, yeah, you could laugh at it. In other words, I laugh at it. But fundamentally, underlying these jokes is this kind of thing that says, you know, taking on marriage is a huge commitment. It is going to hold back a lot of my freedom, okay? Having children is going to hold back a lot of my freedom. Having a career is going to, and yet someone without the gift of marriage and without the gift of children and without the gift of career, no one looks at them and says, wow, you're drunk on the street corner on a Tuesday morning. We're so proud of you. Because that's not freedom. It might feel free, and we use the word carefree, but it's literally carefree. You have no obligation. There's nothing honorable about that. It's irresponsible. It's embarrassing. And yet the true free person is someone who has walked into the obligations of adulthood, has walked into the obligations of taking care of others, and within it has been able to achieve the freedom of their soul. Their soul is now free because you've given it access to its purpose.
Absolutely. I have to agree. I mean, you know, as you say with Viktor Frankl also says that he recommends that the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast is supplemented by the Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. And I have to agree with him, because it is anarchy, as you said. You know, freedom without responsibility is absolute anarchy. And we're seeing that more and more in today's world. You know, Rabbi Talushkin, I'd like your opinion of this, says, talks about who is rich and who is wise. And he says the person who learns from everybody, not necessarily the teacher who's teaching them, but wisdom is accessible to everyone. So it's putting yourself in the position to be a student of a teacher, to learn something more about life that can enhance your life. Do you agree with that? Because I'm sure you yourself know that you've learned from your own, Lubavitcher Rebbe.
100%. His idea is very much based on ethics of our fathers. Ezo chacham alomed mikol adam, who's the wise person? He who learns from everybody else. Some people you learn what to do, and some people you learn what not to do. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that the wise person, a person shows up every day to life as if it's a classroom and asks, what can I learn, right? So you're driving down the street and somebody cuts you off, and now your whole road rage comes on and you start cursing their grandmother's grandmother, okay? Instead of that, you sit there saying, wow, what can I learn? What can I learn? What do I learn about my own anger? How petty my anger is? What do I learn about treating people with dignity on the road? Every little thing is fundamentally God sending us lessons. And often in life, I find God keeps on sending the human being the same lessons until he or she gets it. Often find friends, siblings, family members who seem to end up in the same mess every few years. It's deja vu. It literally feels like Groundhog Day, where you're having the conversation that you had 5 years ago, you're having again. And you're like, the first question is like, God, how could you do this to them? But the second question that you might be worthy asking is, Jack, why are you always coming into the same situations? What is God trying to tell you that you're not listening?
It's almost like putting a board up and continuously banging your head against it and wondering why your head is sore.
Correct. Like, in other words, is God trying to teach you humility? Is he trying to teach you generosity? Is he trying to teach you to be less rigid? But if you learned the lesson of life, it will stop happening to you because you've learned the lesson.
Mm. And you've moved forward into your next
lesson. You're ready to next lesson. You move from grade one to grade two. But if you keep on sitting in the class and all you're hearing is grade one maths, maybe it's not the teacher's fault. The teacher is just teaching grade one. That's their role. Maybe the problem is I'm not graduating grade one.
Absolutely. Telushkin goes on to say, who is a hero? One who overcomes his bad inclinations and works on his weakness, for instance, his temper. So it's exactly what you're saying. And who is rich? I mean, I'm sure you're often, Toss, mentioned, and I know that I heard often after a bar mitzvah, gosh, you know, there were some people really worth a lot there. And you ask, worth what? And, you know, it's what their worth is, material worth out there in the workplace. Or, I mean, what is that worth? You're taking
True worth are the people that actually care about you. True worth is the deep relationships we built. True worth is my connection with my God. But that's very hard to quantify. And when you live in a society that loves success stories, right? You go into the book section, ask an average bookseller which books they sell the most of. It's business books or biographies of wealthy people. Let me see what that person knows. Like, let me learn from Elon Musk's life. You can't become Elon Musk even if you tried. Not sure you would want to, but even if you did want to. But why is that your hero? Why is that your hero? Versus, let me learn about character. Let me read the Bible again. That's the greatest book of wisdom, not just Jewish wisdom, of any wisdom of all time. And understand what makes a character, what made Abraham who he was, and what made Sarah who she was, and what turned Moses into a leader, and how did he overcome their imperfections. And that's a so much richer journey than the journey of wealth. In other words, okay, so you have a lot of money in your bank account, and now your kids are going to get to waste it for all eternity. And why is that your definition of a worthy, wealthy life, a wealthy inner life, right? I often think about it. You sit across people, and some people are fascinating to talk to, and some people are so boring. And often the boring people are not dumb. They have a decent IQ. I saw this meme today. I mentioned earlier that I love memes. So it's a pretty cynical meme, but allow me to share it. It says, people's IQ should be presented like the weather. Actual IQ 125 feels like 85. So the person might be very smart, but they don't have a story to tell. So you sit across them. That's not wealthy. Even if you have a lot of money in your bank account, if you don't have a story to tell, if you don't have things you've worked through in your own mind, lessons you've learned, things you've digested, what have you, like, you know, I often ask people, you've been married for 30 years. What have you learned? I don't know. What have I learned? What do you mean? You've lived with a person for 30 years. You've gone through so much. You've learned nothing. Wake up every single day. You're 50, 60, 70 years old. You've learned nothing. You're just going to send me some cliche that someone else told you. What is that? And that's really the real wisdom in life. And the real wealth is not IQ, the way we define it as knowledge. It's wisdom. What are you learning? What are you picking up? What are you bringing to this world? Right? You know, those. I often think about those grandmothers and grandfathers, many of ours, who could barely read. These were people that were uneducated, but they were so wise.
Absolutely.
Because it means so much about life. You sat with them for 10 minutes and you learned more about life than you could pick up in any book.
And if you ask their children, what did they gain from their parents? It's often, it's not the wealth, it's the love they got in the home. The love that they saw the parents giving to one another. The love that they were encouraged to give to their siblings, to their grandparents, to the people that they interacted with. Those are the wisdom that is passed on from generation to generation. It's not the wealth. It's not the monetary wealth that we have.
Correct. And I would say, like I was talking to my siblings yesterday, I was saying, I think one of the reasons why there's so many therapists out there today and so many of us need therapy, one of the reasons is because we're not getting that wisdom from our grandmother anymore.
Mm.
So now we're paying 1500 rand an hour to sit across somebody who studied the wisdom and got a degree, but fundamentally it's not the same. You're not getting the wisdom from someone that loves you. You're not getting the wisdom in an organic way where you're just basically making an apple cake, you know, together, and suddenly your granny throws one of her wisecracks and, you know, and you learn something from it. For me, that's one of the great losses of our commercialized world, a metropolitan world, is that loss of intergenerational wisdom, right? We come from hundreds of generations of incredible life experience. Everything you need to know about life, your grandmother and grandfather and their parents knew. Somehow we haven't listened to them, and now we're going to all these gurus and paying $5,000 a weekend to hear some dude who literally just had an epiphany yesterday share me some stuff that my grandmother could have said a million times better.
And sitting at the same table with you with no phones interrupting you at all, just listening to her wisdom. I have to agree with you. I must admit my granny taught me some marvelous things, some I won't repeat. But I must admit, I have to agree with you. But at the same time, I must admit, I don't know who your psychologist is, but that's cheap. You'll have to share the name on one of your podcasts.
Rabbis get special discounts.
Is that what it is? You know, you also, one of the other things that you actually spoke about, which I really enjoyed, was this one, when giving up isn't an option. And, you know, you talk about the harrowing footage of Israeli hostages emerging from captivity, you said, their faces etched with exhaustion, yet radiant with an unmistakable glow. And you say, I couldn't help but wonder what fuels their unyielding resilience. How do they manage to laugh, smile, and declare their determination to move forward despite the unimaginable trauma they've endured? Take Agam Berger, you go on to say, just as one example. When 20-year-old Agam Bergen, one of the young women who was released by Hamas from being in the hostage tunnels, and she was handed a whiteboard and offered to write a message to everyone in Israel and beyond. Watching and waiting for her reunion were her family, Agam, with her family, and you say, she wrote, I chose the path of faith. And in the path of faith, I returned. Now, that is so beautiful because one other person also said it. And I'm just trying to think who it was. It will come to me. But when you said that, I thought, you know, that is so beautiful because it is someone who had faced the hardest, the most insecure situation that anyone could ever be in. An uncertainty of her future. And yet she turned and she returned to faith.
But I'll say more than that. I think it's Dafka there. I was listening to one of the captives recently, and he was saying the only thing he misses about captivity is the clarity.
Wow.
Because when you have nothing else to distract you, you have no phone, you have no status, you have no news, you have no games on your computer, you have no social engineering you're trying to do. You're stripped bare from all the nonsense, from all the noise of human living, from all the hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're faced with the gut-wrenching truth, and that is, who am I? And that clarity they had. And that's a clarity that those of us who are blessed to not be in the tunnels, but are distracted by life have to find a way to designate time to re-access that core truth.
And we can learn a lot from those hostages, because so many of them have come out with renewed faith in Hashem. Thank you. We're going to advert.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Rabbi Levi Upson. And if you'd like to WhatsApp us, if you have any questions or you'd like to join our conversation, please do so on 061-895-1019. Rabbi Upson, we're about to hear a very short audio clip by Rabbi Abraham Twersky on personal connection.
I suppose that in some ways I'm at a disadvantage to address the question of how I feel connected to God, because coming from a Hasidic family and coming from a rabbinic Hasidic family, where there is so many instances, so many stories of clear, near miraculous occurrences, that I'm just, that's part of what I grew into, grew up into, and I got it in my mother's milk, right? So that happened with my connection with God. But here and there, I have picked up indications of people who have connections with God that I envied, and that I realized that there are people who've related to God in a different way than I do. I'm at the Kotel, right? And I'm praying, I'm saying the Psalms with as much feeling as I could muster. And I see that they're bringing somebody down to the wall, a blind man. He's a Sephardi with these thin little features and the little peyote. And they bring him down to the wall, and of course he can't see the wall. So he feels the wall, you know, and he's feeling history on his fingertips, you know, kisses the wall. And then he starts off talking to God. I couldn't make out everything. He's saying he's talking a million miles an hour, and he's talking to God and talking to God. And abruptly he stops and he says, "Oh, I told you that yesterday." Right? And I said, "Hey, he's praying much more than I am." Right? He knows that he talked to God yesterday and that God heard him. There's no sense in repeating it. Right? And I realized that was a kind of prayer. Right? There are times when I remember I was at one retreat where a woman was said to me, "I walked past the services today and I saw you were praying. And I stood there and I felt so bad because I don't know anything about prayer. And I wanted to do something. I wanted to pray, but I didn't know how." And I said, "Wait a minute, Bernice. The way you look at it is, I was praying and you were not praying, right? You want to look at it from God's perspective? God sees me coming into the synagogue and he says, 'Uh-oh, here comes Twersky again. What does he want this time?' Every time he comes in, he says, 'God, give me this, God, give me this, God, give me this.' But then he looked at you and he says, 'Look at my child Bernice. She's standing out there. She wants to get close to me. She doesn't know how.' Right? Now tell me, whose prayer was better? My prayer that I verbalized or your silent prayer?" So there's things like this that happen to you that you begin to realize what kind of connection a person can have with God.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Rabbi Levi Upson. Our time is going very quickly. You were listening to the audio clip by Rabbi Twersky, the late Rabbi, beloved Rabbi Twersky. Rabbi, that's part of what he was talking about with the connection. And do you agree? I mean, you know, as he said, a blind man came in one way, and another woman said, you know, she was watching him and she was thinking how she didn't. And we were talking about the hostages. And if I'm tying up the dots and the connections, that the hostage I was thinking of was Emily Damari. And she was asked the question in an interview, and her answer was extraordinary. She was asked, "What did you learn in 2025? And she said, "Firstly, God. I have a very strong relationship with God. I had many conversations with him in captivity, and that relationship continues today. I've also learned to value everything. I open the fridge and I say thank you. I drink cold water and I say thank you. I'm grateful for the big things and the small things. Now, you know, that is the responsibility that we need to teach our children, I think, as well. The responsibility of gratitude, of saying thank you. Thank you for the small things. Thank you for the big things. And that's something that Judaism, with all our brachas, all our blessings over everything that we eat or drink, does teach.
It's interesting. The word gratitude in Hebrew, they don't actually use gratitude. They use a very different term. It's called hakarat hatov, which means recognizing the good.
Ah.
Could be grateful. You have to be able to recognize.
Huh.
So gratitude is point two. If I'm not recognizing that the fact that you give me a cold water is an act of kindness and I see it as an expectation, I'm taking it for granted, then I won't be grateful because what do you mean? Sue Jackson owes me a cup of water. The universe owes me, right? The wealthy people have to take care of me. Everyone owes me everything. Okay, my teachers owe me, my parents owe me, my granny owes me. I have no... Hakarat HaTov means, one second, are you acknowledging that goodness was done? Are you acknowledging that no one owes you anything? And even if they feel obligated to you, you should not feel that they are obligated to you. In other words, as a parent, I have responsibility to my kids, but my kids should not be walking around counting the responsibilities I as a parent has for them. That's very unhealthy. Yes, I brought you into the world and it's my obligation to do the best I can to raise you, but that's not your attitude. That's my responsibility. You, my child, you focus on gratitude. I'm realizing that I don't owe it to you, that there are many children who don't have the gifts that you have. You have a bed to sleep in the night. You have a cup of water in the morning. You have a cup of milk, whatever. You have a school. Say thank you. Not so much because I need it, because you need it.
That is so true. And I think if anything that we can learn from the hostages coming out, it's that in the darkest of darkest tunnels, they found God, and they found something to be grateful for from knowing him and relating to him. You know, my father always said, and I often mention this, that there are no atheists in foxholes, and that he said was very, very obvious in the Second World War when they were flying bombing raids over Germany, and a lot of his team didn't come back. You know, the rest of them sat and they prayed. Whatever they believed or didn't believe, everyone sat and begged for them to come home, their loved ones to come home, or their team members. Thank you. We're going to ad break.
This is Finding Human with Sue Jackson, only on 101.9 High FM.
Hello, this is Sue Jackson, and I'm back with Rabbi Levi Upton. And Rabbi, I know that many questions will come in later, but if anyone would like to send a question in quickly before we end by wrapping up, please do so on 061-895-1019. And also, if you would like to pick up our podcast later, you can on the Chai FM podcast. It's a free app, Chai FM, so please go on to that. Rabbi, you know, I was reading an article about the October 8th and the 9th Jew. But in that article, they were talking about anti-Semitism. Now, you know that these last few weeks, we have been hit quite badly by anti-Semitism in Johannesburg in areas. What have you got to say about that? What about our identity?
I always have an issue with anti-Semitism, not the issue that most people have. It's how much it drives us crazy and how much it shocks us. And suddenly everyone starts talking about it. Like, we remember we're Jewish once people start hating us. I really believe that, yes, there are organizations, the Jewish Board of Deputies, others that have to deal with it. But around my Shabbos table, I'm not talking about it. It's irrelevant. What is relevant is identity. And my identity does not come because you, the ignoramus hater, hates me. That doesn't give me identity, right? Idiots don't define me. I define me. My heritage defines me. And the greatest response to anti-Semitism is to not sit there getting all defensive and begging them to like me and begging them, you know, to see me. That's their journey. That's their problem. My journey and my problem is to become a better version of myself, to be someone that's a light unto the nations. And anyone that has half a brain and half of an integrity will see it. And if not, yeah, they'll be dealt with. And there are organizations to deal with it. But it's not my monkey and it's not my circus. I can't spend my whole day caring about people that hate me. And unfortunately, I know enough of history, both from my own family and Jewish history, to realize there is no cure to the sickness. In other words, people sit there saying, where does anti-Semitism come from? And you're like, hello, darling. Have you studied anything about our 4,000 years of history? Or have you just landed from Mars last night? This identity, our identity is that people of good faith and integrity love us and appreciate us. And those who don't. And they end up destroying themselves. As God told Abraham at the beginning, when he chose him, God tells him, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And the anti-Semites, besides causing the pain to the Jew, the biggest pain they're causing is themselves, because no anti-Semitic society has ever thrived throughout history.
It's so, in a way, we're building our image of ourselves as Jews. It's a reactive image to what people are saying, which is really the wrong way of looking at it, isn't it?
I think way too many people are spending way too much time on Instagram or Twitter, X, trying to respond to the anti-Semites. Do you really think that if you show them they're a hypocrite, they're going to suddenly say, oh, yeah, you're right. I now stand with the Jewish people. I now stand with Israel. No, that's not what happens, because they have hate in their heart and you're wasting your time. And instead of spending your time trying to react and debunk their rubbish, be the best version of yourself. Build the best community possible. Build your family. Build your integrity. Build your place in this world. Add light. We will outlive any of these gangsters, any of these dark people, any of these people who have been possessed by evil. We will overcome them. But the question is, will you spend your time fighting the demon, or will you spend your time becoming the angel?
Absolutely. And that in that article about the ninth of October Jews, it says Judaism has never understood itself merely as a survival project. Survival matters, but survival is not the purpose. The purpose is to shape lives of conscience, depth, and holiness within the ordinary rhythms of time.
Correct. The best thing I could do to build Jewish eternity is build myself, build my children, build my community. Instead of spending an hour screaming at the anti-Semites, come to Shul, learn more about who you are, hang around with friends. You see a lonely person, help them up, give them a hug, say a kind word. That will add so much value to you and the world than defining yourself by what the hater thinks of you.
And so often, you're so right, because so often we underestimate a word. And Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks so often spoke about the power of words. And, just if you think back on your own life and words that have touched you or uplifted you or destroyed you, when I say destroyed, I mean knocked you flat, it's amazing how you can think of both. And sometimes you can either get into the words that destroyed you and go that route, which really is a victim route, or you can go into the words that have helped build you and be grateful for those, because they've steered you in a better direction.
And I'll finish with this. Imagine you're walking down the street and a drug addict who's high as we speak starts cursing you out. Are you going to take it personally? Mm. No, because you realize they're possessed.
Mm.
The same thing with an anti-Semite.
So what is your final word?
Be the best version of me. Keep on evolving. The best response to the haters is to be light, because we will outlive them. But the question is, will I outlive them just as a response, or will I live them as an agent of light and truly change the world?
Thank you so much, Rabbi, on those beautiful words. We will end, and I do agree that we all have it in us to shed that light, and all we have to do is to turn it on. We're going to be ending with a beautiful song. It's called Sim Shalom by the 613, and he talks about Shalom Tova Brocha, which I think means, you can correct me, peace, goodness, blessing. Is that right? That's how we're ending. Thank you so much, Rabbi Avzan. Anyone who would like to listen to our podcast or share it, it will be downloaded later. And Rabbi, I will be seeing you on Shabbos, well, actually on Thursday, Friday night, and Shabbos this week.
Mazel tov.
God bless and thank you. Thank you, Craig.